Science Faction is meant for an adult audience, and pursuant to state law, all performers are wearing properly applied latex condoms.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 272, Science Faction, the origin of the stars.
Once again, I think Carl Sagan is going to say we're infringing on his territory.
The origin of billions and billions and billions.
I think he sounded more like this, more almost like a Muppets character.
Yeah, that's a Kermit the Frog mixed with Carl Sagan.
My Andrew Yan sounds just like Miss Piggy, too.
That is true. Indeed, we are doing our new intro bit, The Origin Of, and last week we covered the origins of the universe, and this time we're going to cover the origins of stars. Now, I know there's a whole bunch of physicists screaming their heads off right now about all the interim periods before that. Just so you guys know, these aren't necessarily sequential, and we may come back to certain elements of this.
If you want us to listen, please leave your comments in the form of a 5-star review on iTunes. I will read the fuck out of that.
That is the only comments we listen to.
And by elements, he means hydrogen.
Yes, yeah, exactly, yeah. Listen, we understand there's a lot of stuff in between it. You guys are nerds, though. You need to get the fact that we have to skip to the interesting parts of this. Right? This is like one of those 6 hours British documentaries. There's some good stuff in there. You just got to fast forward through a lot of crap to get to it.
It's all interesting.
So, indeed. We talked about last week how we had essentially the Big Bang. We had all this stuff shoot out. You had matter and antimatter essentially annihilate each other in a very, very cataclysmic explosion where basically almost the entire universe blew up. You know, you had most of the matter in the universe hit antimatter and most of the matter disintegrated. And all we see that's left is kind of the remains of all of that.
I mean, matter won. We're still here.
That's true. We should have a giant foam finger that just says matter.
I matter.
In the South, they have a Confederate flag that honors antimatter.
I hear they have to keep taking those down from Southern museums.
It's offensive.
And so as we left off, the universe had cooled to a non-plasma state and finally had become transparent. Well, now we have a whole bunch of stuff floating around. As was just mentioned, most of that stuff is hydrogen. About 20-some-odd percent was helium, and you had a few other heavier elements that were the result of certain cataclysmic events within the Big Bang.
Mama EM?
Yes, exactly. Your mama so fattium?
Yes. A lot of the larger elements.
Well, then what started happening is imagine these huge clouds of hydrogen, of again, mostly hydrogen. Well, what happens? We know we have something called gravity. Gravity allows one object to be attracted to another and clump together. So you have one atom of hydrogen floating around. It comes close to another one. They have mutual gravitational attraction. They connect and stick to each other. Then you have a third one floating around. It now comes close to these two that are already stuck together, and they have a higher gravitational attraction, and so they all stick together to form a clump of three, and that keeps happening over and over and over again until that ball gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and you have a massive ball of hydrogen in the middle of these basically gaseous clouds that are in space.
You look at me like I have a joke, but I'm actually siding with the scientists here. This is fascinating.
It is fascinating. Well, and then what happens as this thing gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it hits this thing called the gene mass, which, great name, by the way. And when it hits this mass, the entire thing condenses. And as the gravity just pulls this thing in as a collapse, what happens is what was once transparent hydrogen molecules get so pushed in and so dense as they condense together that they become opaque. That opaqueness keeps some of the energy release, which is done in photons, from getting out as it's crushing in, which restrains and reflects that energy back in, creating an even higher energy system. And a continued gravitational collapse as this comes in gets so strong. Think of the friction and gravity forces at the center of this huge ball of hydrogen being so strong that it actually starts the process of fusion, turning four hydrogens into one single helium and releasing a tremendous amount of energy, which is why basically every star you see, including our own sun, is a huge uncontrolled thermonuclear reaction.
You went a completely different way with gene mass than I did. I pictured one, a Wonka-based religion,
okay,
led by Gene Wilder.
Okay, fair enough.
Two, a KISS-based religion, where, yes, Gene preaches one day, Peter Criss another.
Okay, I was thinking...
Welcome to the Church of KISS!
I thought Gene Mass would be like casual Fridays for church. Like, that's where you show up just in jeans. And once you get this process going, the continued heat and energy release of these huge thermonuclear fusion explosions perpetuate the process, and it keeps burning this hydrogen into helium through this constant reaction and letting out light and energy and heat. Now, something to think about is, when this happens in a star system, you're looking up at the sun right now, that is a huge thermonuclear explosion, right? So you're saying, wait, I am seeing the light of this thermonuclear explosion as it's happening. No, you're not, because not only do you have to account for the 8 minutes of time in between us and the sun that it takes light to get here, you also have to account for the fact that that explosion is happening at the center of that star. Those photons have to bounce around against those other hydrogen and helium molecules for a long time before they get out. Sometimes you have photons that are created in the center of the star that take 10 to 50,000 years to get to the surface of the star to bounce out and come to us. So a lot of times, not only are we seeing ancient stars very, very far away, some of which, by the way, are dead and long gone. We just get their light long afterwards. The light you're seeing isn't even instantaneous. The light you're seeing is thousands of years old. It's been bouncing around in the center of that star before it even got out.
We've discussed on this podcast before that our planet is going through a helium shortage. And once that helium's gone, it's gone. But yes. What you're telling me is essentially there's literally billions upon billions upon billions, yes. To quote Mr. Sagan, of these free helium mines,
right? If you were
up in the space,
all you need to go is travel to the nearest stars and start taking all of their helium, somehow extract the helium out of them.
Isn't it like really light? Doesn't it just kind of float off?
That's right. This is balloons shooting out of the stars.
Well, if we wait long enough, it'll just come to us.
Yeah, that's right. Because those stars will eventually explode and have a supernova. Now,
children's parties can't wait.
When we talk about those ancient stars, those first stars that formed after the formation of the universe, one thing to think about is you're not going to have planets. You can't have things watching these star formations going, man, I hope this star kicks off soon because it's cold as fuck out here. You can't, because all the things that make us up, the carbon that makes up our very bodies, comes from a process that happens later on when this star explodes in a supernova and shoots heavier elements like carbon out. Before that, carbon doesn't exist. It's not floating around. We can't build our bodies out of it and watch these first stars come. We have to have these first stars emerge, burn for billions of years, then go supernova and shoot those heavy elements out into the rest of the universe to later make up our bodies. So what's really neat about it is that first generation had to kind of silently go through this process of being born and living and dying, and then its death throes, its skeletons are literally what we build our own bodies out of.
Are there people or planets that are made of the very first stars, and would they brag about that in the same way that people would brag that their grandparents came over on the Mayflower?
Or maybe like hipsters, like, I'm made from the first stars, see, losers. Well, there's an old saying, I think this was actually a Carl Sagan saying, which was, you are built out of the remains of dying stars. And not only that, but the stars that made the carbon in your left hand are probably different than the stars that made the carbon in your right hand, because they're so varied and we get it from such different places that we are probably built of the remains of many, many different dying stars.
So I was actually right not to wear a costume on Halloween. I was already the walking undead.
You are the walking undead and the current living remnant of a genetic lineage that goes all the way back to the first living thing.
And all but the most autistic person who asked that question stuck around to the end of your description of that costume.
And so that is the origin of stars. Those stars can die in many, many ways. They can burn out. They can become red giants. They can go into a black hole. They can have a supernova. There's a lot of different ways that stars can end up dying. But this is the way that stars end up being born. And thankfully, they are born, because, again, without those first generation of stars, we wouldn't be here to watch the next generation of them continue to burn.
I'm sorry. Did you mention Death Star in your... and your reason stars die?
Is that a small moon? And speaking of stars dying, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. And with me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damian Mercado. Damian, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing great. I'd like to be referred to as the Jar Jar Binks of this show.
You know what? Granted, you are absolutely the Jar Jar Binks of this show.
First concession you've ever given me this show. So I'll take a victory where it's allowed.
Yeah, one more than you deserve. All right. And our scientist for the evening, we got a new one, Dr. Robert. Dr. Robert, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
So, Dr. Robert, I know you from the March for Science, which you're in charge of? You're the head of? How does that work?
I'm one of the co-leaders of.
You're the co-leader of. He's being modest. He's the big boss over at the March for Science.
Mm-hmm. In San Diego, at least.
I'm kind of confused. Can I call you Better Bobby?
What do you do in your actual day-to-day job? What do you study? What do you look for? What's your process?
So I'm studying horizontal gene transfer in bacteria.
So we talked about a little bit about that on the show before. That's where you're able to...
Bacteria missionary position.
No, Damien, no, we talked about that as well. No, this is instead...
It's a little more violent, actually.
This is where the bacteria are able to share genes. They can literally just swap between current living bacteria. They don't have to wait to the next generation, like sexual reproduction. They can literally just get together, swap some genes, and all of a sudden gain the abilities of the other guy, right?
Yeah, you don't have to wait for kids. Just grab the genes yourself.
It's almost like every bacteria is the X-Men rogue, you know? And it sees another bacteria whose superpowers it wants, and it just touches it and then pulls those superpowers away from them.
Yeah. So there's actually three different ways that they transfer genes. One is viruses. So crazy, like, right? Viruses infect bacteria.
Right.
But
bacteriophages, right?
Yeah, exactly. They do, and occasionally they'll accidentally pick up a little piece of DNA from whatever bacteria they were in before and carry that with them, and that transfers over. Another way are these little sex pillises that they use to...
What's a sex pillis?
It's a little rod that sticks out of the cell and injects genetic material into another cell.
And so why don't they just call it a penis? Because that seems like a penis, doesn't that?
Sounds like a translation of the Sex Pistols. If you were to look at in Italy at a Sex Pistols album, it's like Sex Pistols.
Why don't they call it a penis, Robert?
It's a girth issue. It's not
a penis by any other name, Damien.
I mean, in yeast they call a similar thing like a shmoo. So kind of nice.
That sounds like a Yiddish word for penis. That a does. Yiddish euphemism.
So you study how these things transfer genes back and forth.
Yeah. So the third way they do it is to just pick up genes that are floating around in the environment, pick up DNA and suck it in. And people kind of thought like, well, the other two are probably more important because like how often is a great gene just floating around? So what I was doing, I was actually interested in another thing that bacteria can do where they have essentially like a poison-tipped dagger.
Oh.
So we know that bacteria have chemical warfare.
Sure. Right?
That's where antibiotics come from. It's bacteria pumping out poison into the environment to try and kill each other.
Right.
But not only that, but they also have sword fighting. So they can take these poison-tipped daggers and stab other bacteria if they're close enough to them and kill them.
Very cool. Now, when they're stabbing them, are they just damaging the cell membrane? Or are they injecting some kind of something that's destroying them from the inside? What are they doing?
Yeah, they're injecting a toxin that like just eats them out from the inside.
And so
poisons them.
Once they do that, if the bacteria dies and it shoots its genetic material out, and that's how they can pick up stuff later on?
Exactly. So I was interested in this killing thing, the poison-tipped dagger. Uh-huh. I was looking at that under the microscope. I had predators... looked red because I gave him a red gene, and the prey were green because I gave him a green gene.
Very Christmassy.
Predators killed all the prey.
Uh-huh.
And then I was like, just looking under the microscope, some of the predators started turning green.
Really?
And I was like, what is that? And then I realized what's happening.
They're like picking up
what
the green
gene. You
genes?
Just said, I mean, you just picked it up in like 5 seconds. Yeah. I should have you in lab.
They're just picking up those green genes that are lying around. That's really interesting. Now,
did they become prey then at that point?
No, they didn't pick up the weakness. They only picked up the strength.
Now, did you find...
I mean, they could just as easily pick up weakness, but...
Did you find some kind of differential adaption in terms of picking up useful genes and non-useful genes, or did it seem to be fairly random?
Yeah, people ask that all the time. How do they know what to pick up? They don't. They just pick up everything, and then the ones that pick up something bad, if they pick up that weakness, they die. So we don't see them, and we only see the ones that worked, and we think, oh, evolution is genius.
Yeah, well, the great thing about bacteria is the fecundancy and the timeline of the lifespan and everything is so big that you can do these kind of evolutionary experiments, even easier than you can do with, like, fruit flies, because bacteria multiply so much, and there's so many of them, and the process is so quick.
Well, that and poison-tip penises.
Yes, that's true. So this is obviously important for understanding things like antibiotic resistance, right? Because we've talked on this show before about how, especially in hospitals, it seems like what can happen is certain bacteria can pick up genes for antibiotic resistance from other bacteria, and that can be really dangerous because now you can get something like a staph infection that can't be cured.
Oh, yeah. So we've got dozens of antibiotics, right? And evolution is powerful. Evolution is fast. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense that they're going to evolve resistance.
Yeah.
But you can't evolve resistance to dozens of different things all at the same time.
Not unless you're sharing.
Yeah, exactly. So what they do, like these predator guys, they'll let somebody else do the hard work of evolving resistance to penicillin or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then they come in and pick up that resistance gene, gather it, use it for themselves. And that's how you get these bacteria that are just resistant to everything.
So in that process, again, it's a random thing, but seemingly the ones that get the advantage survive in that natural selection type fashion. So they're randomly accepting it. Is there a way we can use this against them? Can we find a way to have an auto-destruct gene that we put around all of this bacteria so that it picks it up and kills itself?
Yeah.
Talking to Will Smith, Jeff Goldblum, give the aliens a cold. Take a mothership.
I've told you before, that movie will save the world one way or another.
Give them a Trojan horse gene.
Yeah. Is somebody working on something like that?
There might be.
Okay.
Patent pending.
Have me on in like another year or so.
Okay, fair enough.
See how
fair
far
enough.
I get. It's a hard problem though, because again, evolution. You could kill off like 99% of the bacteria, get
right.
rid of their resistance. That 1%, give them like 3 hours and exponential growth, they're right back to where they were.
But I feel like if you could inundate their environment with enough of this stuff that they're taking up, and maybe multiple different types, so in case there is some kind of differential pickup based on unique genetic characteristics of that individual bacterium, you put out 3 or 4 different tainted foods, and whatever their taste is, they pick up all 3, hopefully, and one of them will kill them at some point. Or the stuff that they're doing with, maybe it's not instant death. Maybe instant death is a bad thing, because then the ones that don't pick it up have an immediate selective advantage. Maybe what you want to do is what we do with mosquitoes, where you basically genetically make them sterile, so they're still out competing with those other bacteria, still taking up resources and that kind of stuff, but they can't reproduce later on.
Or even make them just less harmful.
Yeah, that seems like a good way to do it as well. And maybe if you could find a way to give a gene that would not only make it less harmful, but give it a selective advantage in the environment, then the ones that are less harmful would outcompete the ones that are.
Exactly. You got to use evolution, work with it. There's no way you're going to fight evolution and win on the long term.
Right.
As the current I Call BS champion, I feel like I should weigh in here.
You won one episode.
I've won many. I'm on a one episode winning streak
like BS,
now.
Right? Yeah.
But I think we should double down on the phage. Aspect.
Yeah.
One,
yeah.
Doesn't matter if they pick up resistance genes because they're a virus. Two, I love the thought that it's justice. Essentially,
you get me sick, I get you sick.
Well, I like the idea of returning the environments that C. diff, antibiotic resistant gonorrhea, and MRSA into the Krasinski family from A Quiet Place. You know, like they're hunted. It's game on.
Now you're the prey. No, the bacteriophages are really interesting in places like the former Soviet Union that didn't have access to antibiotics that we mainly discovered and utilized after World War II, since we were essentially separated for them. Bacteriophages were the number one way they used to fight bacterial infections because they didn't have antibiotics.
Old way was bear.
Yeah, literally up and through the 80s and early 90s, if you were in one of those Eastern Soviet bloc states and you got sick, your only option was a bacteriophage. And that was what they would use. They had specific ones for specific lines. We kind of let that fall because antibiotics were better, but now that we have
and you say, I'm going to give you a virus.
Right, yeah. Well, not just that, but I mean, antibiotics were just more effective. Now that we have CRISPR and we can kind of engineer these bacteriophages much better, I think and especially when we talk about antibacterial resistance, the fact that we haven't made a new antibiotic since 2008 and none are currently in development, and that there are certain bacteria right now that already have complete resistance to all the ones we currently know of, going a different route with phages might be the way to go.
Why hasn't this been jumped on? I mean, we've
been profitable.
Joking about it for here. I mean, I would argue that people with open leaking wounds would pay anything to
the
get
development
that.
So time is so long, and it's just not as profitable.
Have you guys talked about the guy here in San Diego whose life was saved by phage therapy?
No.
So there was, I think he was a retired professor or maybe still professor at UCSD. He was in Iraq, picked up this completely multi-drug resistant infection of Acinetobacter, and nothing, like no drugs worked against it. It was just resistant to everything. They threw everything they could at it. Nothing worked. His wife got in touch with this lab in Texas that were experts in phage.
Huh.
And then they worked for like feverishly trying to put together this phage cocktail that would work on this against this sample of the bacteria. They got it, grew them up, and shipped them over to San Diego, and it worked.
Wow. Yeah, I think it's the next way to go. I mean, once you get past the bacterial resistance, you better have an answer.
It's
hard. You need something.
Yeah. I mean, the bacteria will still evolve resistance to phages.
Yeah.
But the great thing is that the phages will evolve back.
Right. Phage evolve back.
you know, at that point, it's kind of like you have a picture window and there's a tree right below it, you know, and if that tree is growing, eventually it's going to obscure your view. But if the stilts that your house are made on are also made of trees and you grow at the same rate, hopefully you can keep your view by seeing over it the entire time. If your house posts are trees, then you can compete with the tree. If your house posts are solid and dead already, there's not much you can do with that. Robert, what would you say is something that's probably surprising about your field or your specific research that most people, even scientifically literate people, wouldn't assume?
So I was thinking about that. I think probably the most surprising thing about any particular field that even other scientists wouldn't realize is what the actual, what makes it hard. And that's true of almost...
Dudes?
almost any scientific field, right? Like, it seems like so easy. You just read this paper and it's like, well, that was really straightforward.
I don't know that many people read microbiome papers and go, this seems so fucking easy.
I'm so hard.
Like phage, I don't know, just gather some phages and...
Okay, so where is the difficulty that most people wouldn't assume?
So for one thing, I made these great movies under the microscope of this horizontal gene transfer actually happening, bacteria killing each other and stealing each other's genes. And that was just really hard to do just because of the technical problems of the bacteria being really sticky.
Hmm.
So if you want to film bacteria under the microscope, it's kind of hard because they're constantly growing. So if you're filming one,
right,
an hour later, they're like, you
have to move
20
the camera.
Something.
Right.
So you got to have some way to flush them out as they grow and then flush in new nutrients for them to eat.
Sure.
But these guys are just so sticky that they clog the pipes that I was using to flush in and out.
Uh-huh.
So what I had to do was...
Hold on. I think I've already predicted it.
Lube the pipes.
No. He hired a housewife in a chef's hat to pull off each individual clump of bacteria as it was going by. But pretty soon they were going too quick, and she had to start putting them in her mouth and then underneath her chef's hat, and the whole night was a wreck.
That is your go-to, is the Lucy. Lucy conveyor belt joke. That's your go-to.
That's your Rain Man, yeah. Did I get it right? Is that what happened?
Close. It was actually this little elf that I met one day when I was building shoes.
Don't be ridiculous, Bobby.
Yeah. He came out at night and, like, you know, helped out. I figured he's pretty small. He could probably fit in there.
So you're a cobbler as well?
Yeah. Aren't you?
You're an impressive man.
So you were eventually able to kind of manage a system where you could flush these things out and be able to actually create videos of the bacterial regrowth.
Yeah, so
microscope
basically, it's really highly technical. What you do when it clogs is you kind of bring your finger in against your thumb and then just really, really scientifically flick it.
Okay.
A ton of bacteria on that wall.
You're like microbiotic Fonzie, like, just smashing the jukebox to make it work.
Yeah, there's actually a guy in lab who told me that he goes to the gym and, like, works specifically on his flicking muscles.
Yeah.
Like, you know those, like, roll up the weight?
He just does two fingers, thumb and middle.
Oh, this is how bad nerds can get. All right, and speaking of how bad nerds can get, you can go ahead and check out our website at www.thescienceFaction.com for all the articles we cover here, as well as some we don't get to. And if you want to suggest an ungoogleable question for us, you can tweet us at Faction Science. But for now, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
All right, article number one. This one is really interesting, blowing up all the science news sites. Usually we try and avoid the super obvious articles that everybody's talking about, but this one has so much interesting stuff in it that we have to hit it, we have to unpack it. Article number one, does your appendix give you Parkinson's?
No.
Well, maybe.
Let's go home.
So here's
Not yet.
Yeah. Here's an interesting article. It looks at the relation between the appendix and Parkinson's. Now, you guys have probably seen this on CNN, on all the other news sites, they are showing this, but there is some really interesting data when you get really deep into this. So first of all, we can review what Parkinson's is. You guys are probably familiar with it. There's some famous people. Muhammad Ali has it, and we know that he got it, or at least likely got it, as part of a punch-drunk scenario. You can get Parkinson's, or there seems to be higher degrees of Parkinson's.
So you're giving his appendix a pass.
Yes.
Your Muhammad Ali's appendix gets a fucking pass.
Well, you can get certain forms of Parkinson's from head trauma. We know that. We know that there are clusters that are associated with pesticide use. So rural areas tend to get it more. People who use or around certain chemicals or pesticides seem to get it more.
Michael J. Fox get a pass too?
Michael J. Fox seems to be part of a cluster that came from the filming of a specific movie that he did where a whole big group of people who were on that set ended up getting Parkinson's, including Michael J. Fox. They were likely exposed to some of these chemical things that can basically cause or at least bring out Parkinson's in people who are genetically predisposed.
Christopher Lloyd was strung out on H and couldn't make filming that day, but it turned out he was the lucky one.
Yeah, that's right. Well, this is kind of an interesting thing because it means that we know that there are some that are genetic Parkinson's. We can actually see a gene knockout that causes Parkinson's. Those are the most rare. It's only about 10%. 90% are what we call sporadic Parkinson's, meaning you're likely getting it from the environment in some way, shape, or form. There is a very specific thing where the substantia nigra, which is part of your brain, in Parkinson's patients, it loses a certain neuron density. It seems to have certain problems. It can't communicate signals as effectively, and that seems to be the basis, as far as we can tell, for what Parkinson's is. Now, there are some keys or some clues to what might be causing it, including in the brain of Parkinson's patients, we find these kind of shortened proteins. Now, these proteins are normally found in the body in a much longer segment. However, when we see them in Parkinson's patients, they've been shortened. So we talked the other day when we were talking about...
Like rats chewed them off or something?
Yeah, that's probably it.
Somebody filed down these proteins.
That's why it's illegal in most states to have a shotgun barrel cut filed down or the proteins in your substantia nigra. Well, what we found out was these proteins are getting kind of cut short. And like we talked about the other week with prions, a misfolded or shortened protein can do something very different than its original intended purpose because protein usage can be determined by their shape, their folding. So when we see these cut proteins that are shorter, these are the damaged things that seem to be indicating a problem in the substantia nigra. Well, a researcher recently found that these shortened proteins were present not only in Parkinson's patients in their brain, but in their appendix. She then went and started looking at other people's appendixes and found that you could find the precursors to this, which actually seems to make sense because in Parkinson's, before we see neurological issues, we usually see bowel issues. So this is really interesting. There's a high correlation with this. Before people present neurological symptoms from Parkinson's, in most cases, they present some kind of gut issues. So,
is it farting a lot?
Yeah.
Oh my God, contact the IBS community now.
You know, this isn't the only neurological condition. We see this with autism a lot as well. There's a lot of overlap between gut issues and neurological issues in that case. One of the ideas is that maybe you have some kind of thing going on in your gut down there that is producing these shorter proteins. That's bad. And then those shorter proteins work their way up the nerve that connects the gut to the brain. And once they get in the brain, they spread out and they basically cause havoc.
Now, is it that shorter proteins are just more self-conscious than their longer, than their taller protein counterparts?
Yeah, but then
so they start a lot more conflict.
Yeah, well, then they end up heading Scientology. They get way too much power, and now their wife's been out of the public spotlight for 11 years.
Now you have Parkinson's.
So this researcher was looking, and she seemed to find a concentration in the appendix, specifically in people with Parkinson's, but also in healthy people that might end up getting Parkinson's later on. So there was this idea that maybe something's going on in the appendix that is shortening or cutting these proteins, whether it's bacteria that get in there or it's the appendix itself, it is damaging these proteins, then the damaged proteins work their way up the nerve, up to the brain, and then cause some problems with Parkinson's. So the researcher theorized, well, if this is true, people who had appendectomies, at least when they were kids, should have lower instances of Parkinson's. Well, how do you test that? In the U.S., it would be very difficult because of HIPAA laws and a lot of other things and getting a large enough sample size.
Kid gets ice cream after the surgery and less chance of Parkinson's?
Ice cream takes down your Parkinson's chance and increases your chance of drowning. So both of those.
And
oh, confounding variables.
Isn't it associated with polio as well?
So what they decided to do is look at very robust data sets. They looked at this Swiss set of data that had like 1.2 million people in it, basically all of Switzerland. And
there were a lot of holes in that data set.
There were a lot of holes, but it tasted good, so it was worth it. And it's done by weight anyway, so you get the same amount.
Thanks for not shitting on my pun, on my wordplay.
And so they looked at this Swiss set, and they looked at people who had gotten their appendix out early in life and people who hadn't. And they found that if you got your appendix out early, you had a 20% reduced chance of Parkinson's later in life. Very, very interesting. Seems to correlate with their data. They looked even further in the data, and they found that if you were in a rural community, that increased up to 25%. Well, one of the reasons is if you're in a rural community, you're more likely to be exposed to pesticides. If you're exposed to pesticides that we've already talked about can cause Parkinson's, then maybe those pesticides are interacting somehow in your gut, in your appendix, and causing the shorter proteins, and you're more likely to get it. So when you take the appendix out of somebody who is in contact with those chemicals more often, you get an even bigger effect.
I think the more important takeaway message from this is that if you just took your average person, removed their appendix, you could distill that into a poison that is guaranteed to give Parkinson's.
Maybe, David. Maybe that's what you should take from this. Or maybe we could see people in high-risk situations, whether your job or your life livelihood or just the place you live puts you in high contact with things that might give you Parkinson's. Maybe that's a reason to get a preventative appendectomy. Now, again, this won't work once you're an adult. You've already been exposed to those proteins or you've already had them. They've already been working their way. It's a very long process that takes decades. But if you're a kid and you're in one of those environments, maybe we start taking appendixes out even when people don't necessarily need it.
Couldn't we also solve this again with the most popular thing we talk about on this show, but gut bacteria transplants?
Maybe.
Like if that's the root cause, couldn't right. we get all the kids synced up on healthy poo?
And healthy poo might be the answer to this question, you know, in the long run, but knowing what bacteria to put in and how it might affect other things, that's...
You put it all in.
Okay. Yeah, just overdose
it. Let evolution.
Yeah, we start with the bacterial resistant stuff and put all that stuff in there.
Then the phages.
Yeah, it's really interesting because if we could do this, or maybe we don't even need to go that far. Maybe we just find, like you said, if we affect that gut bacteria through antibiotics or other gut bacteria or some other way, maybe we can stop this particular cause of Parkinson's. Because right now, this is a huge problem in older communities. Essentially, once you have it, it's pretty much irreversible. And if you really want to not get Parkinson's, here's what you can do. One, don't get yourself exposed to pesticides and fertilizers. Stay away from other chemicals that are really bad for you. Don't get punched in the head a lot. And as we've talked about on the show before, take up smoking. Because one of the most interesting findings that we have about Parkinson's is that if you really want to avoid it, smoking is the best way. Smokers seem to have some form of inherent immunity against Parkinson's. At least that's what the numbers dictate. Now, maybe it's confounding factors because maybe they're dying earlier or something. But seemingly, smokers who make it to the same age have way lower instances of Parkinson's. It's probably the only good thing about smoking.
No, we've actually talked about this. I believe it had something to do with the dopamine receptors, which I believe is one of the root causes of Parkinson's. And because I remembered making the joke that everybody hates the guy with Parkinson's at the Smokers Anonymous meeting because that guy can quit like that. Like, that was also a side effect, was that, like, smokers with Parkinson's find it really easy to quit.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's hard to hold that cigarette. It shakes everywhere. But, yeah, so right now, if you don't want to take up smoking, stay away from this. Maybe we find a way to treat the appendix. But it is an interesting correlation that might be an interesting causation because we've talked about so many things we're finding within the past 5 years that are gut bacteria dependent, that seem to be related to our guts that we didn't realize was affecting our everything like we covered last week, the speed at which we walk to our other mental health, to instances of depression, to our ability to process certain foods. All of this seemed to come from gut bacteria. Even things like mood disorders seem to be somewhat associated with gut bacteria, as do certain conditions like autism. So very interesting that we're finding this entire part of our body that is basically occupied by other creatures living inside of it has such a substantial impact on our health.
If what you want, which is preventative or perhaps absolute appendectomies. Uh-huh. I think it's a branding thing. I think we need to brand it differently. So no more appendix. That term, get it out of Grey's Anatomy. No longer there.
Uh-huh.
Instead, we're calling them Parkinson's sacs or Parkinson's scrotums. I think you get it. I think everybody'd want a Parkinson's scrotum out of their body.
Now we might have some other factors coming in. There might be, like we've talked about, correlational factors. It might be an issue of long lifespan. It might be the people who are more likely to have an inflamed appendix are also more likely to get some other condition that prevents Parkinson's. There could be a lot of confounding factors we haven't figured out yet, but keep in mind, this was not just found as a correlation. Somebody didn't just look at a big data set and say, hey, look, I noticed this thing about appendixes and Parkinson's. This was a researcher who found a causal mechanism, then went and looked at big data to try and confirm their research. That is usually a more solid piece of evidence than just somebody noticing a correlation within big data sets.
Okay, so for all you people out there looking up where the appendix is and grabbing onto your kitchen knife.
Yes.
I want to warn you, antibiotic resistance. So that's the problem with any kind of surgery at all. Anytime you open up your body, there's the threat of infection, especially the appendix is chock full of bacteria. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine, I'm not a surgeon, but I would imagine that the probability of infection is probably a little bit higher if you're doing an appendicitis. And remember, there's a lot of bacteria and increasing number of bacteria floating around out there that are resistant to everything.
And a lot of them are in hospitals too.
Yeah. So don't open yourself up to infection if you don't have to.
That's a good point, because you do have to take some wild antibiotics too once you get off that surgery table, right? And so you are also probably contributing to the antibiotic resistance as well, because every person who takes antibiotics is one more vector for a pathogen to be able to get antibiotic resistance.
And that's actually one reason why people are really, really worried about antibiotic resistance. It's not just the fact that, okay, people get infected. It's that surgeons are going to be like, I actually don't want to do this surgery on you because I'm not certain you'll survive. Because normally I just give the patients like this huge dose of antibiotics after I cut them open and then they're fine. But I don't know.
Couldn't you just wash your hands first, asshole? Stop coming in here after changing the oil on your Trans Am.
You can either wipe or wash my hands. You don't get both.
All right. On article number two, the end of paralysis. Also another very interesting article, also very, very cool. This, now again, we're going to talk about this not as a study in terms of looking at a whole bunch of patients, but really more of a proof of concept type thing. The N number on this is a whopping 3. So there are 3 people in this particular study. But this is not the idea of, hey, what does this look like in big numbers? This is this possible or not? And what they did was electrical stimulation of the nerves in order to take paralyzed people and allow them to walk. Very interesting process called STIMO or STIMO. And basically, they're stimulating the lumbar nerves that actually help a person move their legs.
STIMO sounds like what I left on the hood of your car after you tried to take away my iCall BS victory last week.
It does sound like that. No, so what are they doing? They're taking people who have paralysis. They're hooking up electrodes to the nerves, kind of right leading right onto their legs, and they're stimulating those nerves and allowing them to walk along with some kind of like body weight machinery that takes some of their weight off of them.
Can you set the machine to like funky?
Yeah, like make a dance. Well, I was thinking about this. Think how hard this is. Take yourself out of this. Now, if you were to just say, hey, we stimulated a nerve and made something move, that's not a big deal. That's like the doctor with the hammer hitting your knee at the physical, right? This is something very different. Think of what it takes to walk. Think of the motor control it takes to walk. Think of the ability. Just think of one step. So think of standing up. Now you're standing up. You're supporting your entire body weight, top heavy, up above your pelvis. You then take a step forward where you're essentially falling forward, moving your leg in front of yourself to catch you, stepping, rolling your heel to your foot, shifting the weight from your back foot to your front foot, then shifting back over as you bring that leg up. It's a very complex set of movements. It's not just a single fire or not fire.
Data from the Next Generation actually said something very similar to what you said. He just did it way less autistic. I believe it was way more human than what I just heard.
You know, now that you got me thinking about it, I'm not sure I'm going to actually be able to do it.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it seems super daunting once you figure it all out. You got to put hip flexors in there. You got all that kind of stuff working. So we've talked about previous studies where they were kind of able to make people move their legs a little bit and even sort of walk, but this is really...
Like shooting guns at their feet?
I thought you said you didn't want anything, Spider. But, you know, think how difficult that is to actually make them walk. In previous studies, they've kind of made them move a little bit. They've been able to kind of make a little bit of progress sort of walking. These patients each walked over a kilometer, both with the STIMO and the weight assistance that helped take their body weight off. But they're performing a very complex set of movements and balances using almost a video game controller to help make themselves walk, which is really, really neat. Now then extrapolate what you'd be able to do with this a couple generations down the line. You can think about, you know, just taking a patch and essentially going around the damage. You have one patch above the damage where the nerves come in and it receives the signals and then it sends it down around the damage to the other nerves below it. The other thing that's really interesting with this particular scenario is even after they took the STIMO off, the machine is off, these people are just back to their normal sense, they have increased movement in their legs. Now, it's not like they're unparalyzed or anything, or they're even as good as they are with the machine on, but they do have increased leg control and movement. That's amazing. That means that this machine is not only temporarily helping them move while it's on, it is somehow stimulating the regrowth, regeneration, or neuroplasticity of nerves that allow them to be able to move their legs once the thing gets turned off. That is really neat.
Could I set the machine to actually make somebody more clumsy? Like, could I actually use it to train them to to be less dexterous, or perhaps make their movements more awkward?
Could train it to give them Parkinson's, right? That would work.
No, I don't have Parkinson's. I just have asshole friends.
And you could see how this would be absolutely gigantic for anybody with paralysis, because it is theoretically the way out. You know, this particular device isn't going to do it, but this device on the 32nd generation might be what helps a regular paralyzed person get up and actually walk out of their seat. Especially when you talk about what paralysis does to an individual. Think of what that does to your lifestyle. I mean, that's not the same as even just losing a leg where you can throw a crutch on and still walk around and still be active. You're talking about you need a special van, you can't go upstairs anymore.
You can't live in a majority of places that are available to rent.
Using the restroom, anything is so impacted. If you can think of something simple, especially a mechanistic cure for it as opposed to a chemical cure where you have less interaction differences, that is something that's really big for these people who otherwise have their entire lives changed by something like paralysis. Yeah,
there's no way you could ever become a world-famous physicist.
No, not at all. That would be like having no legs and yet somehow becoming an Olympic speed runner.
Wheelchair.
And then shooting your wife.
Wheelchair fetishes are really uncommon.
So that's a really interesting thing. But I was also thinking of what this could do further down the line. So let's say we use this to cure paralysis. Great. But what else can you do? Because think of what they're doing, essentially. They're recording and replaying movements or nerve series of movements that a person does in order to do a particular activity, in this case, walking. Again, think down the line, 35th, 55th generation of this. Let's say you take somebody who's able-bodied and can do a very precise mechanistic thing that they've trained their entire life to do, a pro soccer player, the best guy in the world, kicking a soccer ball. You hook these little sensors up to his nerve fibers along his vertebrae. You record the motion as he goes and kicks that goal. Then you do that enough, and you essentially get the nerve firing sequence he uses to do this very complex set of interactions that he has perfected. Could you then slap this on your average everyday dude who's never played soccer before and basically use them like an avatar and train their nerves to do this reaction, which again, as we're seeing with these people, you retain some of that training after the device is off?
I say you use this to end bullying. I mean, like, if you don't know, if you're a bully, and now any kid, no matter how physically superior you feel, you don't know that he had a Muhammad Ali pre-Parkinson's robot program for him.
I'm thinking more of like the Morpheus Neo thing where he learns Kung Fu. They just download it into him. You're essentially programming your body, because a lot of what that is muscle memory. What we call muscle memory, which is basically the nerves firing in a certain sequence, some of which, by the way, doesn't even have to do with the brain. We actually have nerve clusters in parts of our spine that allow us to perform certain mechanisms without the brain even being involved, especially things that we train our muscles to do over and over again. So imagine taking that experience, that ability that you hone over years and years and years, and being able to just transmit it to someone almost instantaneously. Now, again, that's not what these researchers are saying. This is a far-off futuristic prospect that I'm proposing. But think of this avenue and what we could do with things like this, being able to literally control another person's body. You slap one of these devices on, connect to the nerves, and all of a sudden I can take that guy and move him around with my iPad.
Seems like there'd be some consent problems, like issues with...
I just think of this as the next generation of the NFL. Like, the coaches now, they're playing Madden, basically, but with real people.
Yeah, except one of the coaches hacks in and puts Damien's clumsy program in there.
Yeah, exactly.
That's part of the game, man. If you ain't cheating, you ain't trying.
Tom Brady is running like a girl now.
The next generation, like, sign stealing.
Yeah, that's the next generation of steroids. You know, it's all going to be digital as opposed to chemical. Very interesting stories this week. Robert, thank you so much for joining us for your first ever episode of Science Faction. And thank you, audience, for coming back for Science Faction 272, where you learned about the origin of the stars, how your appendix might be giving you Parkinson's, and how we might soon see the end of paralysis. Thank you so much for joining us. And please come on back this Thursday for Science Faction 273.
Either A, Michael J. Fox got Parkinson's from a Parkinson's cluster while shooting a movie, or B, Biff is really good at the revenge long game.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.